I'm going to begin with the 9th Central London demonstration yesterday. According to the headlines, there were 11 arrests. I saw one of them. Wasn't quite sure what she was arrested for, and I'm not quite sure whether they managed to hold her. The fact of the matter is that, as with all of these demonstrations, they were militant, but not nasty, not full of hate or anything remotely like that. I mean, of course, there was a mixture of out and out pacifism. That's perfectly understandable, but also, militant. Anti-imperialism. And so, as with all these demonstrations, there was a Jewish contingent, which usually is quite militant. And I saw our old ultra-Orthodox Jews as well at the beginning of the demonstration lined up. And of course, far from being attacked or disabused, they were clapped and people were eager to take their photograph or take photographs alongside them. True Jews denounce Zionism, true Jews consider the state of Israel an abomination, which is true in religious terms. Okay. Should be said that in terms of me getting our little weekly worker team together, I had a little bit of difficulty. Why? Because first of all, other than the organisers advertising the demonstration to be in central London, there were no details coming through until not quite the very end, but nonetheless, things were left fine. My guess, I didn't actually ask anybody, but my guess on this one is that they were in negotiations with the Metropolitan Police. And on this particular occasion, when I did read where we were meant to be rallying, which was Marble Arch and Hyde Park, Speaker's Corner. That we had two different times. So on Stop the War site, it said 12:30. On the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, it said 12. And then when I arrived, I was told by comrades, oh, well, it's now going to start at 1:30. And the reason why it's starting at 1:30 is along the route. Going from Hyde Park down Kensington High Street towards the Israeli embassy. They would never get to the Israeli embassy, of course. There was a synagogue, either directly on the route or off the route. And because there was some service going on there, the march was delayed. Well, this is an absurdity, as I've already indicated, hence my introductory remarks about the Jewish bloc and the ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionist Jews. No synagogue would have been attacked. It's a complete nonsense, but it's another excuse to clamp down on people's right to protest. So, if you recall, we had Suella Braverman and her hate march and calling for the Met Police to ban it. They said, we can't unless there's certainty of, or near certainty of, serious public disorder. We've had all sorts of restrictions placed on people, what they can shout, what they can give out. So, if you happen to have, a pamphlet that combined the swastika with the Star of David. You could be arrested for that. If you have an image of paragliders, you can be arrested. If you shout out anything that can be interpreted as pro-Hamas, you can be stopped. I think, for example, on the previous demonstration, the Socialist Workers Student Society, they had their banner intercepted and taken away by the police before they gave it back because it said victory to the resistance. So there's all sorts of restrictions in place. And of course, this time, as in previous demonstrations, the organizers have been told, well, you have to finish by X, Y, or Z o'clock. And this is in spite of them imposing a late march on them. So, as I said, instead of starting at 12 o'clock or 12:30, it was 1:30, and it was on the dot of 1:30 that the thing started to move, because on earlier demonstrations, so big have the numbers been that the police themselves, I would guess, again, I'm not in the inner circle, but my guess is that the police and the organisers have agreed the thing starts early because the space that they've got in terms of streets or parks or squares isn't big enough to hold the numbers. And this time, although the police gave, well, another risible number, they said 30,000 with 1,000, I think, 800 or something like that, police on duty. Just absurd that the ratio of demonstrators to police would be that. Other sources, such as the BBC this time, and Sky TV, and the organisers, and I presume they just take these figures from the organisers, are talking about between 200 and 250,000. So it was a big demonstration. It was, roughly speaking, I didn't time it, but it was roughly the same sort of size as the previous demonstration. And that's despite people not knowing exactly where it was leaving from, as I said, until very, very late in the day. Meanwhile, what's going on in Gaza? Again, I'm in no position to judge, with any inside knowledge, other than to say, well, we all know what's going on. The population in Gaza, including in the north, including in the center, there are still people there. There are still Palestinians there, are suffering from hunger. They're suffering from lack of clean water, lack of medical supplies, leave aside the Israeli army. And of course, in the south, people have been told to vacate Khan Yunis, and now they're being told to vacate Rafah. Well, as we said from the beginning, that seems to be the Israeli plan, but where do people go? I spoke last week about satellite imagery of the Egyptian wall that's being constructed along the Gaza border, along with a deep ditch. And this wall is, you know, very high, topped with razor wire. And we also know that Egyptian soldiers have been given instructions, if they see anyone moving in the no man's land, to shoot them. Well, this week, although it's been denied, we have satellite imagery of the Egyptians clearing a certain area. How people judge it, I don't know, but I read that would be enough to house, in inverted commas, 100,000 people. Well, when you consider that in the extreme south of Gaza, we now have, what, between 1.5 million, whatever the exact figure is, does anyone know? That's a tiny percentage. So, as I say, although the Egyptians deny it, that they're planning either to open, the border, or turning a blind eye as Israel, removes sections of this border wall. I don't know. Either way, from the standpoint of ordinary Gazans, it could easily be a situation of where you either go to Egypt or you die, from hunger and disease. And under those circumstances, I wouldn't be surprised. However much people are tied to the national cause, and I think something like 9/10 of the Gazan population, originate from elsewhere in Palestine. So, as with the West Bank, what you've got is a refugee population plus people, who've got ancestral roots to that particular patch of the land. But in Gaza, it's a tenth, that can trace their ancestors back. So I wouldn't be surprised at all that that's what Israel is planning, just to leave people with no choice, the choice between dying or leaving. And of course, from Egypt's point of view, and I'm talking about the government, what they fear is okay, you make provision for 100,000, maybe 1 million people in the Sinai. What you immediately set up is a permanent conflict between Egypt and Israel, because you can guarantee it that for every Hamas fighter that Israel has killed in its military operation, it's effectively recruited 10 people for the future in terms of want to take up arms against the hated Israeli Zionist state. So from an Egyptian point of view, this isn't something that they want. That would mean the end of their peace treaty with Israel. But also, what happens in the street in Alexandria or Cairo? What do people do there? I mean, we're talking about a weak regime. We're talking about a regime with no genuine popular mandate, who actually fears their own population and would also fear the Palestinian refugee population. And of course, in terms of at least the last free elections that there were in Egypt, a very rare occurrence. What happened to the horror of the military regime is the Muslim Brotherhood was elected as the largest party in the parliament. And of course, we had a Muslim Brotherhood president. And of course, we all know that Hamas is a branch of, an offshoot, if you want, of the Muslim Brotherhood. They have the sh same pan Muslim ideology. They share the same founder teachers, same ideological influences, etc. Okay. I thought it was interesting looking at a recent YouGov poll, because this was a poll taken of the British population and their attitude to Gaza, Israel, Palestine. And this is tracking the views of the British population from November, so that's after October the 7th, to this month, to the middle of February. And what struck me in particular was the massive gulf that separates, extraordinarily pleased, the mass of the British population from what you might call the political class. And what it shows you is that far from these massive demonstrations that there have been in central London, representing some sort of highly political, highly motivated minority, that what we actually see when we look at the attitudes of the mass of the British population is that these demonstrations, and they're not just happening in London, they're happening in other cities in the UK, Glasgow, Cardiff, but also regional demonstrations as well, is that this is much more the tip of the iceberg. So these demonstrations do represent not a minority of the population in Britain, but a majority of the population in Britain. As I said, I was pleased by it, and I have to express my surprise because I do remember the Iraq War, and I do remember the opinion polls. And you can fool some of the people some of the time, and you can fool most of the people some of the time. And that was true with Iraq. And so, although we had huge demonstrations, if you look at opinion polls, you still had people, majority of people, who believe the lies of Tony Blair and George Bush. Well, it's not the case now. And so I'm just going to give you a snapshot. I haven't written them all down, but I just to use the shift from November to February. But three questions, and the three questions were about: do you support or do you oppose the continuation of Israeli military action? Should there be negotiations with Hamas? And was Israel justified in terms of its response, its military response to October the 7th? Well, okay, so the first one was about continued military action, and what we see there in November is those that support that statement that Israel should continue its military action. That has in November the support of, in terms of those that replied to this poll, I don't know how it was conducted, whether it was telephone or whatever, but 19%. So in November, 19% said yes, Israel should continue. So I presume this is hunt Hamas down until they're finished, something along those lines. Now in February, that's down to 13%. Those that disagree, that was 59% in November, up to 66%. So those that are calling for ceasefire now, something that is opposed by Keir Starmer, something that's opposed by Rishi Sunak and the so-called political class, 66% of the British population oppose that. 66% of the population go along with the main slogan of Stop the War Coalition, Muslim Association of Britain, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, CND, and all the rest of it. Okay, negotiate with Hamas. Well, you can't negotiate with Hamas, says our British political class, because, as they say, with every single BBC mention of Hamas on the news, it's designated a terrorist organization by many countries, including the United Kingdom. Well, in terms of should you negotiate, November, 61% of the British population was saying negotiate. Now that's gone up to 66%. Those that oppose that, 16% in November, down to 11% in February. Last one, much more ambiguous. Was Israel justified? No, said 44% of the population, so a minority. But remember, if you take these figures, we've still got the don't knows, right? But anyway, 44% said no, it wasn't, and that's basically remained unchanged in February. It's gone up to 45%. 29% thought that Israel was justified in November last year. 24% say it's justified, was justified, not is, was justified. So looking back at November, not, excuse me, not November, October the 7th, obviously with a mass of propaganda and this image of Hamas coming out of nowhere, just attacking Israeli civilians and kidnapping people and all the rest of it, it didn't fool most of the people most of the time. It only fooled some of the people some of the time. Okay. Meanwhile, we've had interesting vote in Scotland. I didn't expect it. I'm not up in Scotland, obviously, but this is the Labour Party conference in Scotland that unanimously passed a resolution. I mean, I have listened to the resolution. I haven't gone and looked it up, and I'm sure I'd have all sorts of problems with the resolution. Nonetheless, they did pass a resolution that called for a ceasefire now, something that's been specifically opposed, of course, by the British government in the UN, and specifically opposed by Keir Starmer, who uses the weaselly formulation of what he wants is a permanent ceasefire. So he's got to oppose a temporary ceasefire. Carry on killing people. We'll support American arms supplies. We'll participate in arms supplies as well. We'll cut off UN, relief agency, and all the rest of it. But no, a unanimous resolution in Scotland. So that's significant. Because this is in the midst, after all, of the continuation of the anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism witch hunt, where even allies of Keir Starmer have found themselves in the firing line and have found themselves deselected. So we've had two prospective parliamentary candidates, one actual on the ballot paper. For the 29th Rochdale by-election. He's still on. He is a prospective parliamentary candidate, but he ain't a Labour prospective parliamentary candidate. He was Labour leader of in the on the Lancs Council, not leader of Lancs Council, but the Labour Party councillors. He's no longer that, of course, because he's suspended from the Labour Party. He is someone under investigation. And of course, the betting now is that George Galloway, former MP from Bradford, former MP for up there in Dundee, former MP up there in Glasgow, former MP up there, well, down across the road in Bow in East London, he's not only now in with a good chance, he's now in with a very a good chance. Of winning that seat. It's true that there is the distinct possibility of him being an MP for a very short time. In other words, winning late this month and then in the general election being swept aside, as people choose a government as opposed to a protest vote or whatever you want to call. The 29th, if people do elect George Galloway. Okay, and of course, showing the logic of the witch hunt, we have Mike Katz, who's the chairman of the Jewish Labour Movement, used to be called Pole Zion. It's a Zionist organization, it's affiliated to the World Zionist Congress. He's called for all those people who are at the same meeting as Ali and Jones, Labour candidates who've been removed, all of these people, and I don't know how many there were at this meeting, all of them ought to be suspended because they're all suspect. I find this remarkable. I mean, I was asking a comrade, and I didn't know the exact answer, and I'm still not sure. I haven't looked it up, but I was told, and I trust the answer, that the reason McCarthyism came to an end. Was because it went so far that it was going into the armed forces and was looking at generals, was looking at colonels, was getting in to the core of the American state. And when you get people like Mike Katz calling for, even if there's no suspicion, there's no recording of someone saying something, that there's the sort of implication of guilt. Well, you were in the same room. What about Keir Starmer then? I mean, not only did he sit next to Jeremy Corbyn in the shadow cabinet for years, he's also been on Palestinian Solidarity Campaign platforms, local meetings down there in St Pancras and Holloway. What did he say when he got up on those platforms with the big Palestinian flag? I'm a Zionist and I support Israel? No, of course not. He came out with some bloody formulation around his solidarity with the Palestinians, with his hopes to see a Palestinian state, and how unjustified and how barbaric the treatment of the Palestinian people have been. And I have to ask myself, and I do ask myself, how comes in the election when we had Ed Miliband, remember him? And the press, at least the right-wing press, pillowed him. You know, he couldn't eat a sandwich properly. But what they called him is Red Ed. Well, the only thing red about Ed was his father, Ralph Miliband, who wrote a reasonably good book, well, a pretty good book, in fact, called Parliamentary Socialism, as well as other such books. So his father was a Red. Was Ed a Red? Well, no, it's absurd. Of course he wasn't a Red. He wasn't a socialist. He was a bourgeois. Of course he was. And so what about Sir Keir? Well, Sir Keir not only has got a history of being in the shadow cabinet with Jeremy Corbyn and speaking on pro-Palestinian platforms, he's got a Trotskyist background, and he's got the best Trotskyist platform you could want if you're the Daily Mail or the Sun or the Telegraph. And that is, of course, he was a member of something called Socialist Alternatives that most people wouldn't know anything about. But this organization was what they call a Pabloite organization. And what it specialized in throughout the world, this was the plan of Pablo, is that you infiltrate social democratic parties, you infiltrate official communist parties, you keep your head down, you act the chameleon while you're in it. You gain positions of influence, and then you emerge, and you take people with you as events move to the left. So, if we're talking about dishonesty, if we're talking about people being red and having, you know, well, he's lying, isn't he? As he would, I change my mind in whenever the date happens to be. Sakir is your ideal candidate, but clearly. The establishment, you know, are looking to keep or to re restore the Labour Party as a safe second 11, or perhaps as the replacement for the Tories and Rishi Sunak. Maybe that will all change come the general election campaign, and we'll hear all this nonsense. I don't know, but it is significant, surely, that we haven't heard anything. Remotely like that. All we've had when it comes to Sakir is either praise for him or criticism that the Labour Party remains the same and he ought to be purging more and more and more people. But no criticism of him in terms of his origins or history, even recent history. Just a very quick comment. I was reading Socialist Worker, and not just any article, but a We Think article. So, presumably, by Charlie Kimber, the editor of Socialist Worker and Team Socialist Worker. And it was saying that people in Britain face a choice between a disintegrating political centre or the rise of fascism. And it was painting a picture. Basically, Britain in a revolutionary situation, and its answer, which is pathetic, is more demonstrations of the sort that we saw yesterday, you know, 200,000, 250,000. But combine that, they were saying, with the sort of strikes that we saw last year around the health service, teaching, lawyers, you name it. And somehow that's the answer to what's going on. But of course, is the centre collapsing? Well, certainly when it comes to Rochdale, Sir Keir's had a pretty bloody horrible time. That's certainly true. And seeing George Galloway return to Parliament will not be a happy day as far as the Labour front bench is concerned. But also, what we had on Thursday, surely, is a picture of what will happen, or something like what will happen, if opinion polls are to be believed in a general election. In other words, two pretty stunning Labour Party wins. Wellingborough, Labour Party, compared with 2019, admittedly not a good year, but up 19.5%. This is percentage of those that voted, by the way, not of the total electorate, but up nearly 20%. Tories down nearly 40%. So they were down 37.6%. And a lot of that went to Reform, who got 13% of the poll. Lib Dems were nowhere, 3.1%, and the Greens were nowhere again, 0.1%. And I'm not going to bother with the others. There were no left-wing candidates, or no candidate that was on the left that you can really locate in any serious sense. And then we have Kingswood, Labour Party plus 11.5, Tories down 21.3, Reform, first-time candidate, 10.4%, Greens, 3.4%, and that's it. So the idea of the political centre collapsing and the Labour Party being part of that collapse, I think, is Charlie Kimber and the SWP trying to keep its activists excited and back out onto the streets in a couple of weeks' time, when there'll be another, I'm sure, mass demonstration in solidarity with Gaza and the Palestinian people. But crucially, where's the political challenge? Where's the political challenge to this political class that's clearly, when it comes to Gaza, when it comes to Palestine, completely separate from the mass of the British population? That's our problem. And if you look at the potential challenges, well, clearly George Galloway is George Galloway, but his Workers' Party is full of non-entities. And I'm not saying that rudely. You cannot replicate George Galloway, in 650 constituencies come a general election. His Workers' Party, what sort of a project is it? Very strange political party with a program written by Harpal Brar and his son and daughter, full of praise of the Soviet Union and Cuba and China. But also combining that with a background of lending their vote, lending their support to Nigel Farage and the Brexit party. So it's a sort of, well, I know it's no surprise to anyone here. It combines Stalinism. Stalinism is a form of nationalism, but it's usually a form, usually, of left-wing nationalism. So what we had in the form of the Workers' Party wasn't left-wing nationalism. It was trailing behind Farage. That doesn't make, as some have alleged, the so-called Alliance for Workers' Liberty, doesn't make George Galloway a right-wing politician. It makes him a very inconsistent left-wing politician. That's what George Galloway is. Anyway, you just look around what else there is. Tusk. No one's going for Tusk except the Spartacist League and, quite frankly, political dust. It's a non-goer. It wants a Labour Party Mark II, but on the left, it's basically looked at as a spew project, as a project of Hannah Sell, invented by her predecessor, Peter Taff and Clive Heemskerk, as their alternative to the which had potential, the Socialist Alliance of Yore. Either way, it doesn't seem to have any legs, and that's our problem. We don't live in a pre-revolutionary situation. We're not in a revolutionary situation, but we urgently need a viable political alternative. And from our angle, the project isn't a Labour Party Mark II. The problem with that is there's still the Labour Party Mark I. Whatever the nature of the Keir Starmer leadership, we still have the trade unions affiliated. If you look at these Tory seats, we're still going to have a situation come a general election. The mass of working class people identify with Labour, the mass of working class people will vote Labour. Okay, moving on. This week in the paper, we'll have an article marking and looking back at the Ukraine war, second anniversary of the so-called special military operation, January the 22nd. I think it needs to be emphasized that as well as it being the second anniversary, it's also the 10th anniversary. All wars are a continuation of peace. All wars are a continuation of war. And of course, what happened before the special military operation could be described as a war, could be described as a civil war. Because, of course, what you had in 2014 was the Maidan revolution. I think it's much better described as the Maidan coup. A CIA operation where a legitimately elected, I don't think anyone disputes that, a president was overthrown by force. Yes, it's true they had a vote in parliament, but only 70% of the MPs were there. The rest were basically keeping their heads well down. Either way, what we then saw is an outburst of anti-Russian sentiment. Now, that's one thing when it's directed at a foreign country. It's not excusable, but it's sort of, well, okay. But of course, 20% or thereabouts of the Ukrainian population identify themselves as Russian, and a good percentage of the Ukrainian people, of course, would be bilingual, would dream in part in Ukrainian and dream in the other half part in Russian. They have the same origin. Loads of binational marriages and all the rest of it. But we had a wave of anti-Russian chauvinism, and of course, being threatened. With a Ukrainian takeover of Crimea, which of course was given to the Soviet Republic of Ukraine by Khrushchev. Russia under Putin acted and annexed Crimea to much public acclaim back home. And of course, we had, okay, helped by Russia, but nonetheless, spontaneous rebellion in the south and in the east by Russian speaking Ukrainians. And I'm distinguishing between what I would call Ukrainian Ukrainians and Russian Ukrainians. So, what has happened since? Basically, yeah, this town or that town has changed hands. But in general, what we've seen, in spite of the huge loss of people, is a war of attrition. And we've had the recent statements after the failure of the Ukrainian summer offensive, in spite of all the Challenger and Leopard 2 tanks. We've had that statement from what was the commander in chief of the Ukrainian forces, that what they've arrived at is a stalemate. That doesn't mean that it's an end to fighting.
I've lost all my. Nobody listens to me anymore.
I can't blame them, Jerry, but if you could just mute yourself, this is me doing the political opening. and you're very welcome to come in the discussion. But it is really difficult if comrades are heckling. I don't mind heckling, but on a meeting like this, it's very difficult. I'm just going to also switch the light on because it's getting dark here and I need to see my notes. There we are. Okay. So we've not only had the statement that there's a stalemate in Ukraine, we've also had two, I think, important political developments. And that's the fall after many months of fighting of Avdiivka in Donetsk. It's right next to the city. I don't know how many people died, but the new commander in chief, apparently known in Bakhmut, that what we were told was a strategically important town. I always said it's nonsense to talk about that being strategically important. Okay, so Russia takes it. What then happens? Well, if it holds it, it holds it. But it's certainly not going to be, from Bakhmut, it's a straight road to Kiev. No Ukrainian forces would have been dug in. Russian forces weren't just going to then sweep all before them. And of course, what happened is basically, well, there was a new line, on the map, just a shade of Russian again, and that was it. And I suspect myself that's going to be true this time around, except with the potential difference. And again, it's very hard, if not impossible, at least for someone like myself, to separate what's politics here and what's the truth. Because what we are being fed with at the moment is Ukraine is completely outgunned. And it's being outgunned in the form of artillery and the lack of European, but crucially American supplies. Now, this matters on this battlefield. This battlefield is very similar, okay, on a much lower level, to World War I on the Western Front. It's tanks are gone. Planes are gone. We've got drones, we've got missiles, but crucially, it's infantry. And in terms of gaining ground and in terms of stopping infantry, it's artillery. So, what you do is you bombard the other side, you force the other side to cower in their trenches. And what we're told, I don't know, obviously. But we're told that Russia, in terms of the shells that it fires and has available to it, has an advantage of 10 to 1. In other words, it can continually bombard and bombard the other side, and the other side can only reply on comparative terms on rare occasions, which means that there's no possibility of offensive action if that's true. On the other hand, this withdrawal and this story that we've been forced back and the perilous position of Ukrainian forces, I think, it certainly helps with at least making the case to the US Congress to agree to this 90 billion arms package, which includes 60 billion. To Ukraine. I don't know how you separate fact from fiction on this one. It could be a combination of both. I don't know. But clearly, if American arms don't come forward, that would be a great advantage to Russia, to put it mildly. Will NATO, will Joe Biden allow it? Will the Republicans be content to take, your friend of Putin? Well, we've seen, I was quite surprised with the Tucker Carlson interview when Tucker fed Putin. I thought, with a, well, you know what the reply to that one's going to be. basically, do you back Joe Biden or do you back Donald Trump? He didn't get back. Well, of course, I support Donald Trump because he says he will settle this war within 48 hours. He didn't commit himself. But since then, we've had the statement, from Putin that actually he prefers Trump, not Trump, but Joe Biden, because Joe Biden is predictable. And Trump, of course, has been trumping this. Personally, I take that as good advice to Putin that if you want Trump, back Biden. That's my reading of it. Either way, maybe I'm being too cynical, but I don't think so. Now, I would emphasize that we should not fall for the nonsense that's coming from Trump, or for that matter, Trump supporters that believe his line. That if he was elected president, he'd solve it in 48 hours. That he would come to a settlement with Putin. I don't think there's any reason to believe that. And indeed, we need to understand that when we're looking at the Ukraine war, we're not only dealing with a continuation of politics that go back before February 2022 or February 2014. We need to, very least, to go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, to Yeltsin, to the elevation of Putin, and Putin asserting the authority of the regime against the West. We've gone from a situation of where he's a man we can do business with, talk of Russia entering NATO. To a situation because Putin and the FSB regime in Moscow don't want Russia simply reduced to a oil and gas reserve for Europe. They've asserted their authority, and that means asserting their authority also when it comes to elections. And so if we look at elections, of course, we all know that they're fixed. Because we all know if they weren't fixed, you would get a candidate who would do the bidding of the dollar short term until a couple of days ago, of course, for Navalny. We have no illusions in Navalny. Of course, we have no illusions in Putin. And would Navalny end up as the West friends, or would he just be a different version? Of Putin. I don't know. But the difference is between Navalny and Putin is not their Russian chauvinist outlook, but the fact that Putin is connected with the core power in Russia, which is the bureaucracy, which is the army, the police force, the secret service, the FSB. That's the nature of this. Regime. Okay. So, of course, I would blame the Putin regime for the death of Navalny. I don't know what they're going to tell us. He had this attack or that attack. But for me, it's as I don't really need to be convinced. I have met comrades on the left who were convinced that, for, remember the failed Novichok attack in Salisbury, told, swore blind that this had to be MI5. Oh, come on, comrades. It's pretty obvious. And it's pretty obvious, when someone's plane falls out of the skies over Moscow, who's responsible for it? Or this oligarch jumps out of a high window, who's responsible for it? This is Putin. And this is Putin basically saying, if you diss this regime, if you rebel against this regime, this is what you should expect. And it's not only what you should expect if you live in Russia, if you go abroad, you're also in danger of getting it. So it's fear that's being engendered. It's a mafia type fear, but it's Putin. And if someone wants to argue that, Navalny, I don't know, had a suicide, sudden decision to commit. No, I just don't. I don't buy that. I don't see why we want anything other than what's pretty damned obvious, unless someone comes with definitive proof that it was something different. We don't need apologetics for Putin in order to oppose our own side. And that's the other point here, because Biden and Trump are united, even when it comes to rhetoric in terms of curbing the Euro ambitions of France and Germany, and crucially, curbing, bringing down its main strategic rival, which isn't Russia, which is a real, it's armed with nuclear weapons, yeah, sure, which isn't a serious economic power at all. No, it's China that is the United States' only serious strategic contender, and it's a long, long, long way ahead of China. After all, what the United States has still, and even more so after February the 22nd, is NATO, the G7, the EU. All of that is subordinated to the United States. And what Russia has is the BRICS. Well, you can add it up in terms of population, but the fact that it includes India shows you that this isn't a coherent ideology. This isn't a coherent alternative to the United States. It's some, I can't remember what the economist who coined the term, can't remember their name, but this is an arbitrary grouping that's since been added to, but that has no political coherence whatsoever. Meanwhile, in the United States, and I think we have to explain this. Here you are, there's Donald Trump, who's just been fined. And what's the total in New York? Over $300 million for exaggerating the size of his assets. I thought that's what men are meant to do anyway, isn't it? Let alone businessmen. Of course, they come along to their bankers and they say, I'm worth $2 billion. And the bankers, of course, I would presume, do their own research. Either way, of course, he will appeal. But here's someone not only with civil suits against him, but with criminal prosecutions against him. And yet, here he is, not only running head and head with Biden, but he's running ahead in terms of the popular opinion polls. Now, that matters because, of course, the presidential election in November is not direct, it's indirect, it's through electors, it's through states. And of course, what happens is that the Republicans have, at least for I don't know how many years, an inbuilt advantage in terms of the states where they dominate. The Democrats have an inbuilt disadvantage. In other words, the Democrats to win not only need a majority of the popular vote, they need a majority of the popular vote plus, 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 where the Republicans, if they get half the popular vote, that usually means that they are easily winners because of the nature of states, which everyone knows. So we need to explain what's going on. Why aren't people rallying to Mr. Sensible Biden or the alternatives that are available? I would say there has to be something about the crisis of liberalism. That if we look at what the SWP was saying about Britain, I think it applies much more to the United States. Not that there's a revolutionary situation, but the center, if we can describe Biden as that. And so, you've got Bernie Sanders, the DSA, who are some sort of force in American politics, even though they don't represent the majority or anything like that. But they are a genuine force of some sort. Well, it's the center that's collapsing. It's the center that's disappointing people. And of course, the nature of a presidential system is to concentrate on the individual. Either the individual is incredibly charismatic or solve all your problems or whatever. And of course, in Joe Biden, what we have is not a particularly charismatic individual. And I have to say that I don't know whether he was well advised or spectacularly wrongly advised, or whether he just rode roughshod over his advisors. I don't know. But his reply to the prosecutor, who said, "This is why we're not going to prosecute the guy for keeping, classified documents in his garage," whether his advisors said, "Well, come out fighting, Joe, really roast this guy and get really upset about not remembering, when your son Beau died," to me that would be very bad advice. I'm getting on, and I'm not going to boast, for example, about my memory is perfect. And I, for example, here's me. If I boasted I could pronounce every foreign word, let alone English word, perfectly. Now you make fun of yourself. You don't play to your weaknesses, you play to your strengths, and you make fun of yourself. Self-mockery is a very good defense. And so the fact that in his statement, about his memory, he got Mexico and Egypt and President Sisi and Mexico confused. Well, if you're angry, that's an embarrassment. If you're making fun of the fact that you do make fluffs, but basically you're part of a team, and I've got tons of experience. Yes, I've got a history going back ever since I was 20s. I used to make fluff ups. But to deny that, to claim almost 100% perfect memory is clearly ridiculous. I don't know what the answer is, but the problem that the Democrats have got at the moment is, one, we're leaving it very, 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 very late in the day. And what would be the natural replacement, surely, in a presidential system is the vice president. As I understand it, she's even more unpopular, and that's the right word to use, isn't it? Unpopular than Biden. So I don't know. But this does lead me precisely not to the view that the SW editorial had, that it's that or the rise of fascism. Nonetheless, if we're going to be play fast and loose with our language, which I don't like doing, but if we talked about an authoritarian right, if we talked about an additional Bonapartist, how should I put it, character to the United States, I would go along with that. And Trump's statement, "I'm not going to be a dictator except for day one," I take that seriously, except I don't just believe day one. And that's why, at least, I would speculate and warn that you could potentially get a move by the Democrats, the state corps, who knows who, the army, high command, to overthrow democracy in order to save democracy. And what you then have is a situation of both in Washington and in Moscow, you get regimes that have an eerie resemblance to them. Putin will be elected, I would guess, next month, and a regime that stops Trump winning, for example, by arresting the Supreme Court or whatever they do, would have something very similar to the FSB regime, the FSB army police regime in Moscow. I'm going to finish with that.